forever. There was a chain across the short driveway that led down to the lake, and a warning sign forbidding entrance to people or to vehicles. "Thin ice," it said. Beneath it was a hand-painted sequence of pictograms with lines through them. No cars, no pedestrians, no snowmobiles. Danger. Shadow ignored the warnings and scrambled down the bank. It was slippery. The snow had already melted, turning the earth to mud under his feet, and the brown grass barely offered traction. He skidded and slid down to the lake and walked carefully out onto a short wooden jetty. And from there he stepped down onto the ice. The layer of water on the ice, made up of melted ice and melted snow, was deeper than it had looked from above, and the ice beneath the water was slicker and more slippery than any skating rink, so that Shadow was forced to fight to keep his footing. He splashed through the water as it covered his boots to the laces and seeped inside. Ice water. It numbed where it touched. He felt strangely distant as he trudged across the frozen lake, as if he were watching himself on a movie screen, a movie in which he was the hero. A detective, perhaps. He walked toward the clunker, painfully aware that the ice was too rotten for this and that the water beneath the ice was as cold as water could be without freezing. He kept walking, and he slipped and slid. Several times he fell. He passed empty beer bottles and cans left to litter the ice, and he passed around holes cut into the ice for fishing, holes that had not frozen again, each hole filled with black water. The clunker seemed further away than it had looked from the road. He heard a loud crack from the south of the lake, like a stick breaking, followed by the sound of something huge thrumming as if a bass string the size of a lake was vibrating. Massively, the ice creaked and groaned, like an old door protesting being opened. Shadow kept walking as steadily as he could. "This is suicide," whispered a sane voice in the back of his mind. "Can't you just let it go?" "No," he said aloud. "I have to know," and he kept right on walking. He arrived at the clunker, and even before he reached it, he knew that he had been right. There was a miasma that hung about the car, something that was at the same time a faint, foul smell and was also a bad taste in the back of his throat. He walked around the car looking inside. The seats were stained and ripped. The car was obviously empty. He tried the doors. They were locked. He tried the trunk. Also locked. He wished that he had brought a crowbar. He made a fist of his hand inside his glove. He counted to three, then smashed his hand hard against the driver's side window glass. His hand hurt, but the side window was undamaged. He thought about running at it. He could kick the window in, he was certain, if he didn't skid and fall on the wet ice. But the last thing he wanted to do was to disturb the clunker enough that the ice beneath it would crack. He looked at the car. Then he reached for the radio antenna. It was the kind which was supposed to go up and down, but which had stuck in the up position a decade ago, and, with a little waggling, he broke it off at the base. He took the thin end of the antenna. It had once had a metal button on the end, but that was lost in time, and, with strong fingers, he bent it back up into a makeshift hook. Then he rammed the extended metal antenna down between the rubber and the glass of the front window, deep into the mechanism of the door. He fished in the mechanism, twisting, moving, pushing the metal antenna about until it caught, and then he pulled up. He felt the improvised hook sliding from the lock, uselessly. He sighed, fished again, slower, more carefully. He could imagine the ice grumbling beneath his feet as he shifted his weight. And slow, and he had it. He pulled up on the aerial, and the front door locking mechanism popped up. Shadow reached down one gloved hand and took the door handle, pressed the button, and pulled. The door did not open. "It's stuck," he thought. "Iced up, that's all." He tugged, sliding on the ice, and suddenly the door of the clunker flew open, ice scattering everywhere. The miasma was worse inside the car, a stench of rot and illness. Shadow felt sick. He reached under the dashboard, found the black plastic handle that opened the trunk, and tugged on it, hard. There was a thunk from behind him as the trunk door released. Shadow walked out onto the ice, slipped and splashed around the car, holding onto the side of it as he went. "It's in the trunk," he thought. The trunk was open an inch. he reached down and opened it the rest of the way, pulling it up. The smell was bad, but it could have been much worse. The bottom of the trunk was filled with an inch or so of half-melted ice. There was a girl in the trunk. She wore a scarlet snowsuit, now stained, and her mousy hair was long and her mouth was closed, so Shadow couldn't see the blue rubber band braces, but he knew that they were there. The cold had preserved her, kept her as fresh as if she had been in a freezer. Her eyes were wide open, and she looked as if she had been crying when she died, and the tears that had frozen on her cheeks had still not melted. "You were here all the time," said Shadow to Allison McGovern's corpse. "Every single person who drove over that bridge saw you. Everyone who drove through the town saw you. The ice fishermen walked past you every day, and nobody knew." And then he realized how foolish that was. Somebody knew. Somebody had put her here. He reached into the trunk to see if he could pull her out. He put his weight on the car as he leaned in. Maybe that was what did it. The ice beneath the front wheels went at that moment, perhaps from his movements, perhaps not. The front of the car lurched downward several feet into the dark water of the lake. Water began to pour into the car through the open driver's door. Lake water splashed about Shadow's ankles, although the ice he stood on was still solid. He looked around urgently, wondering how to get away, and then it was too late, and the ice tipped precipitously, throwing him against the car and the dead girl in the trunk. And the back of the car went down, and Shadow went down with it, into the cold waters of the lake. It was 9:10 in the morning, on March the 23rd. He took a deep breath before he went under, closing his eyes, but the cold of the lake water hit him like a wall, knocking the breath from his body. He tumbled downward into the murky ice water, pulled down by the car. He was under the lake, down in the darkness and the cold, weighed down by his clothes and his gloves and his boots, trapped and swathed in his coat, which seemed to have become heavier and bulkier than he could have imagined. He was falling still. He tried to push away from the car, but it was pulling him with it, and then there was a bang which he could hear with his whole body, not his ears, and his left foot was wrenched at the ankle, the foot twisted and trapped beneath the car as it settled on the lake bottom, and panic took him. He opened his eyes. He knew it was dark down there. Rationally, he knew it was too dark to see anything, but still he could see. He could see everything. He could see Allison McGovern's white face staring at him from the open trunk. He could see other cars as well. The clunkers of bygone years, rotten hulk shapes in the darkness, half buried in the lake mud. Each one, he knew, without any question, had a dead child in the trunk. There were more than 100 of them. Each had sat out on the ice, in front of the eyes of the world, all through the cold winter. Each had tumbled into the cold waters of the lake when the winter was done. This was where they rested. Lemme Hautala, and Jesse Lovett, and Sandy Olson, and Joe Ming, and Sarah Lindquist, and all the rest of them. Down where it was silent and cold. He pulled at his foot. It was stuck fast, and the pressure in his lungs was becoming unbearable. There was a sharp, terrible hurt in his ears. He exhaled slowly, and the air bubbled around his face. Soon, he thought, soon I'll have to breathe, or I'll choke. He reached down, put both hands around the bumper of the clunker, and pushed with everything he had, leaning into it. Nothing happened. It's only the shell of a car, he told himself. They took out the engine. That's the heaviest part of the car. You can do it. Just keep pushing. He pushed. Agonizingly, slowly, a fraction of an inch at a time, the car slipped forward in the mud, and Shadow pulled his foot from the mud beneath the car, and kicked, and tried to push himself out into the cold lake water. He didn't move. The coat, he told himself. It's the coat. It's stuck, or caught on something. He pulled his arms from his coat, fumbled with numb fingers at the frozen zipper. Then he pulled both hands on each side of the zipper, felt the coat give and rend. Hastily he freed himself from its embrace and pushed upward away from the car. There was a rushing sensation, but no sense of up, no sense of down. And he was choking, and the pain in his chest and in his head was too much to bear, so that he was certain that he was going to have to inhale, to breathe in the cold water, to die. And then his head hit something solid. Ice! He was pushing against the ice on the top of the lake. He hammered at it with his fists. But there was no strength left in his arms, nothing to hold on to, nothing to push against. The world had dissolved into the chill blackness beneath the lake. There was nothing left but cold. This is ridiculous, he thought. And he thought, remembering some old Tony Curtis film he'd seen as a kid, I should roll onto my back and push the ice upward and press my face to it and find some air. I could breathe again. There's air there somewhere. But he was just floating and freezing, and he could no longer move a muscle, not of his life dependent on it, which it did. The cold became bearable, became warm, and he thought, I'm dying. There was anger there this time, a deep fury, and he took the pain and the anger and reached with it, flailed, forced muscles to move that were ready never to move again. He pushed up with his hand and felt it scrape the edge of the ice and move up into the air. He flailed for a grip and felt another hand take his own and pull. His head banged against the ice, his face scraped the underneath of the ice, and then his head was up in the air, and he could see that he was coming up through a hole in the ice, and for a moment all he could do was breathe and let the black lake water run from his nose and his mouth and blink his eyes, which could see nothing more than a blinding daylight and shapes, and someone was pulling him now, forcing him out of the water, saying something about how he'd freeze to death, so come on, man, pull, and Shadow wriggled and shook like a bull's seal coming ashore, shaking and coughing and shuddering. He breathed deep gasps of air, stretched flat out on the creaking ice, and even that would not hold for long, he knew, but it was no good. His thoughts were coming with difficulty, syrupy slow. Just leave me, he tried to say. I'll be fine. His words were a slur, and everything was drawing to a halt. He just needed to rest for a moment, that was all, just rest, and then he would get up and move on. Obviously, he couldn't just lie there forever. There was a jerk. Water splashed his face. His head was lifted up. Shadow felt himself being hauled across the ice, sliding on his back across the slick surface, and he wanted to protest, to explain that he just needed a little rest, maybe a little sleep. Was that asking for so much? And he would be just fine if they just left him alone. He didn't believe that he had fallen asleep, but he was standing on a vast plain, and there was a man there with the head and shoulders of a buffalo, and a woman with the head of an enormous condor, and there was Whiskey Jack standing between them, looking at him sadly, shaking his head. Whiskey Jack turned and walked slowly away from Shadow. The buffalo man walked away beside him. The Thunderbird woman also walked, and then she ducked and kicked, and she was gliding out into the skies. Shadow felt a sense of loss. He wanted to call to them, to plead with them, to come back, not to give up on him, but everything was becoming formless and without shape. They were gone, and the plains were fading, and everything became void.
This ends Disc 17. American Gods, Disc 18.
The pain was intense. It was as if every cell in his body, every nerve, was melting and waking and advertising its presence by burning him and hurting him. There was a hand at the back of his head, gripping it by the hair, and another hand beneath his chin. He opened his eyes, expecting to find himself in some kind of hospital. His feet were bare. He was wearing jeans. He was naked from the waist up. There was steam in the air. He could see a shaving mirror on the wall facing him, and a small basin, and a blue toothbrush in a toothpaste-stained glass. Information was processed slowly, one datum at a time. His fingers burned. His toes burned. He began to whimper from the pain.
"Easy now, Mike, easy there," said a voice he knew.
"What?" he said, or tried to say. "What's happening?" It sounded strained and strange to his ears. He was in a bathtub. The water was hot. He thought the water was hot, although he couldn't be certain. The water was up to his neck.
"Dumbest thing you can do with a fellow freezing to death is to put him in front of a fire. The second dumbest thing you can do is to wrap him in blankets, especially if he's in cold, wet clothes already. Blankets insulate him, keep the cold in. The third dumbest thing, and this is my private opinion, is to take the fellow's blood out, warm it up, and put it back. That's what doctors do these days. Complicated, expensive, dumb.
The voice was coming from above and behind his head.
The smartest, quickest thing you can do is what sailors have done to men overboard for hundreds of years. You put the fellow in hot water. Not too hot, just hot. Now, just so you know, you were basically dead when I found you on the ice back there. How are you feeling now, Houdini?
It hurts, said Shadow. Everything hurts. You saved my life.
I guess maybe I did at that. Can you hold your head up on your own now?
Maybe.
I'm going to let you go. If you start sinking below the water, I'll pull you back up again.
The hands released their grip on his head. He felt himself sliding forward in the tub. He put out his hands, pressed them against the side of the tub, and leaned back. The bathroom was small. The tub was metal, and the enamel was stained and scratched. An old man moved into his field of vision. He looked concerned.
"Feeling better?" asked Hinselman. "You just lay back and relax. I've got the den nice and warm. You tell me when you're ready. I got a robe you can wear, and I can throw your jeans into the dryer with the rest of your clothes. Sound good, Mike?"
"That's not my name."
"If you say so."
The old man's goblin face twisted into an expression of discomfort. Shadow had no real sense of time. He lay in the bathtub until the burning stopped and his toes and fingers flexed without real discomfort. Hinselman helped Shadow to his feet and let out the warm water. Shadow sat on the side of the bathtub, and together they pulled off his jeans. He squeezed, without much difficulty, into a terrycloth robe too small for him, and, leaning on the old man, he went into the den and flopped down on an ancient sofa. He was tired and weak, deeply fatigued, but alive. A log fire burned in the fireplace. A handful of surprised-looking deer heads peered down dustily from around the walls, where they jostled for space with several large varnished fish. Hinselman went away with Shadow's jeans, and from the room next door Shadow could hear a brief pause in the rattle of a clothes dryer before it resumed. The old man returned with a steaming mug.
"It's coffee," he said, "which is a stimulant, and I splashed a little schnapps into it, just a little. That's what we always did in the old days. A doctor wouldn't recommend it."
Shadow took the coffee with both hands. On the side of the mug was a picture of a mosquito and the message, "Give blood. Visit Wisconsin."
"Thanks," he said.
"It's what friends are for," said Hinselman. "One day you can save my life. For now, forget about it."
Shadow sipped the coffee. "I thought I was dead."
"You were lucky. I was up on the bridge. I'd pretty much figured that today was going to be the big day. You get a feel for it when you get to my age. So I was up there with my old pocket watch, and I saw you heading out onto the lake. I shouted, but I sure as heck don't think you could have heard me. I saw the car go down, and I saw you go down with it, and I thought I'd lost you. So I went out onto the ice. Gave me the heebie-jeebies. You must have been under the water for the best part of 2 minutes. Then I saw your hand come up through the place where the car went down. It was like seeing a ghost seeing you there."
He trailed off.
"We were both damn lucky that the ice took our weight as I dragged you back to the shore."
Shadow nodded.
"You did a good thing," he told Hinselman,
and the old man beamed all over his goblin face. Somewhere in the house, Shadow heard a door close. He sipped at his coffee. Now that he was able to think clearly, he was starting to ask himself questions. He wondered how an old man, a man half his height and perhaps a third his weight, had been able to drag him, unconscious, across the ice or get him up the bank to a car. He wondered how Hinselman had gotten Shadow into the house and the bathtub. Hinselman walked over to the fire, picked up the tongs, and placed a thin log carefully onto the blazing fire.
"Do you want to know what I was doing out on the ice?"
Hinselman shrugged.
None of my business.
You know what I don't understand, said Shadow. He hesitated, putting his thoughts in order. I don't understand why you saved my life.
Well, said Hinselman, the way I was brought up, if you see another fellow in trouble...
No, said Shadow, that's not what I mean. I mean, you killed all those kids. Every winter. I was the only one who had figured it out. You must have seen me open the trunk. Why didn't you just let me drown? Hinselman tipped his head on one side. He scratched his nose thoughtfully, rocked back and forth as if he were thinking.
Well, he said, that's a good question. I guess it's because I owed a certain party a debt, and I'm good for my debts.
Wednesday?
That's the fella.
There was a reason he hid me in Lakeside, wasn't there? There was a reason nobody should have been able to find me here. Hinselman said nothing. He unhooked a heavy black poker from its place on the wall, and he prodded at the fire with it, sending up a cloud of orange sparks and smoke.
This is my home, he said petulantly. It's a good town.
Shadow finished his coffee. He put the cup down on the floor. The effort was exhausting.
How long have you been here?
Long enough.
And you made the lake?
Hinselman peered at him, surprised.
Yes, he said. I made the lake. They were calling it a lake when I got here, but it weren't nothing more than a spring and a mill pond and a creek.
He paused.
I figured that this country is hell on my kind of folk. It eats us. I didn't want to be eaten. So I made a deal. I gave them a lake, and I gave them prosperity.
And all it cost them was one child every winter.
Good kids, said Hinselman, shaking his old head slowly. They were all good kids. I'd only pick ones I liked. Except for Charlie Nelligan, he was a bad seed, that one. He was, what, 1924, 1925? Yeah, that was the deal.
The people of the town, said Shadow. Mabel, Marguerite, Chad Mulligan, do they know?
Hinselman said nothing. He pulled the poker from the fire. The first 6 inches at the tip glowed a dull orange. Shadow knew that the handle of the poker must be too hot to hold, but it didn't seem to bother Hinselman, and he prodded the fire again. He put the poker back into the fire, tip first, and left it there. Then he said,
"They know that they live in a good place, while every other town and city in this county, heck, in this part of the state, is crumbling into nothing. They know that."
"And that's your doing."
"This town," said Hinselman, "I care for it. Nothing happens here that I don't want to happen. You understand that? Nobody comes here that I don't want to come here. That was why your father sent you here. He didn't want you out there in the world attracting attention, that's all."
"And you betrayed him."
"I did no such thing. He was a crook. But I always pay my debts."
"I don't believe you," said Shadow.
Hinselman looked offended. One hand tugged at the clump of white hair at his temple.
"I keep my word."
"No, you don't. Laura came here. She said something was calling her here. And what about the coincidence that brought Sam Black Crow and Audrey Burton here on the same night? I don't believe in coincidence anymore."
Sam Black Crow and Audrey Burton, two people who both knew who I really was, and that there were people out there looking for me. I guess if one of them failed, there was always the other. And if all of them had failed, who else was on their way to Lakeside, Hinselman? My old prison warden up here for a weekend's ice fishing? Laura's mother? Shadow realized that he was angry. "You wanted me out of your town. You just didn't want to have to tell Wednesday that was what you were doing."
In the firelight, Hinselman seemed more like a gargoyle than an imp.
"This is a good town," he said.
Without his smile, he looked waxen and corpse-like.
"You could have attracted too much attention. Not good for the town."
"You should have left me back there on the ice,"
said Shadow. "You should have left me in the lake. I opened the trunk of the clunker. Right now Allison is still iced into the trunk, but the ice'll melt. And her body'll float out and up to the surface, and then they'll go down and look and see what else they can find down there. Find your whole stash of kids. I guess some of those bodies are pretty well preserved." Hinselman reached down and picked up the poker. He made no pretense of stirring the fire with it any longer. He held it like a sword, or a baton, the glowing orange-white tip of it waving in the air. It smoked. Shadow was very aware that he was next to naked, and he was still tired and clumsy and far from able to defend himself. "You want to kill me?" said Shadow. "Go ahead, do it. I'm a dead man anyway. I know you own this town. It's your little world. But if you think no one's going to come looking for me, you're living in a dream world. It's over, Hinselman. One way or another, it's done." Hinselman pushed himself to his feet, using the poker as a walking stick. The carpet charred and smoked where he rested the red-hot tip as he got up. He looked at Shadow, and there were tears in his pale blue eyes.
"I love this town," he said. "I really like being a cranky old man and telling my stories and driving Tessie and ice-fishing. Remember what I told you? It's not the fish you bring home from a day's fishing. It's the peace of mind."
He extended the tip of the poker in Shadow's direction. Shadow could feel the heat of it from a foot away.
"I could kill you," said Hinselman. "I could fix it. I've done it before. You're not the first to figure it out. Chad Mulligan's father, he figured it out. I fixed him, and I can fix you."
"Maybe," said Shadow. "But for how long, Hinselman? Another year? Another decade? They have computers now, Hinselman. They aren't stupid. They pick up on patterns. Every year a kid's going to vanish. Sooner or later they'll come sniffing about here, just like they'll come looking for me. Tell me, how old are you?" He curled his fingers around a sofa cushion and prepared to pull it over his head. It would deflect a first blow. Hinselman's face was expressionless.
"They were giving their children to me before the Romans came to the Black Forest," he said. "I was a god before ever I was a kobold."
"Maybe it's time to move on," said Shadow. He wondered what a kobold was. Hinselman stared at him. Then he took the poker and pushed the tip of it back into the burning embers.
"It's not that simple. What makes you think I can leave this town even if I want to, Shadow? I'm part of this town. You going to make me go, Shadow? You ready to kill me? So I can leave?"
Shadow looked down at the floor. There were still glimmers and sparks in the carpet where the poker tip had rested. Hinselman followed the look with his own and crushed the embers out with his foot, twisting. In Shadow's mind came, unbidden, children, more than 100 of them, staring at him with bone-blind eyes, the hair twisting slowly around their faces like fronds of seaweed. They were looking at him reproachfully. He knew that he was letting them down. He just didn't know what else to do. Shadow said, "I can't kill you. You saved my life." He shook his head. He felt like crap in every way he could feel like crap. He didn't feel like a hero or a detective anymore, just another fucking sellout, waving a stern finger at the darkness before turning his back on it.
"You want to know a secret?" asked Hinselman.
"Sure," said Shadow, with a heavy heart. He was ready to be done with secrets.
"Watch this."
Where Hinselman had been standing stood a male child no more than 5 years old. His hair was dark brown and long. He was perfectly naked, save for a worn leather band around his neck. He was pierced with two swords, one of them going through his chest, the other entering at his shoulder, with the point coming out beneath the ribcage. Blood flowed through the wounds without stopping and ran down the child's body to pool and puddle on the floor. The swords looked unimaginably old. The little boy stared up at Shadow with eyes that held only pain. And Shadow thought to himself, "Of course. That's as good a way as any other, of making a tribal god." He didn't have to be told, he knew. You take a baby and you bring it up in the darkness, letting it see no one, touch no one, and you feed it well as the years pass, feed it better than any of the village's other children, and then, 5 winters on, when the night is at its longest, you drag the terrified child out of its hut and into the circle of bonfires, and you pierce it with blades of iron and of bronze. Then you smoke the small body over charcoal fires until it is properly dried, and you wrap it in furs and carry it with you from encampment to encampment deep in the Black Forest, sacrificing animals and children to it, making it the luck of the tribe. When eventually the thing falls apart from age, you place its fragile bones in a box, and you worship the box. Until one day the bones are scattered and forgotten, and the tribes who worshipped the child god of the box are long gone, and the child god, the luck of the village, will be barely remembered, save as a ghost, or a brownie, a kobold. Shadow wondered which of the people who had come to northern Wisconsin 150 years ago, a woodcutter perhaps, or a mapmaker, had crossed the Atlantic with Hinselman living in his head. And then the bloody child was gone, and the blood. And there was only an old man, with a fluff of white hair and a goblin smile, his sweater sleeves still soaked from putting Shadow into the bath that had saved his life.
"Hinselman!"
The voice came from the doorway of the den. Hinselman turned. Shadow turned, too.
"I came over to tell you,"
said Chad Mulligan, and his voice was strained,
"that the clunker went through the ice. I saw it had gone down when I drove over that way and thought I'd come over and let you know, in case you'd missed it."
He was holding his gun. It was pointed at the floor.
"Hey, Chad," said Shadow.
"Hey, pal," said Chad Mulligan. "They sent me a note, said you died in custody, heart attack."
"How about that?" said Shadow. "Seems like I'm dying all over the place."
"He came down here, Chad," said Hinselman. "He threatened me."
"No,"
said Chad Mulligan. "He didn't."
"I've been here for the last 10 minutes, Hinselman. I heard everything you said. About my old man, about the lake."
He walked further into the den. He didn't raise the gun.
"Jesus, Hinselman! You can't drive through this town without seeing that goddamned lake. It's at the center of everything. So what the hell am I supposed to do?" "You got to arrest him. He said he was going to kill me," said Hinselman, a scared old man in a dusty den. "Chad, I'm pleased you're here."
"No," said Chad Mulligan, "you're not."
Hinselman sighed. He bent down as if resigned, and he pulled the poker out from the fire. The tip of it was burning bright orange.
"Put that down, Hinselman. Just put it down, slowly. Keep your hands in the air where I can see them, and turn and face the wall."
There was an expression of pure fear on the old man's face, and Shadow would have felt sorry for him, but he remembered the frozen tears on the cheeks of Allison McGovern. Hinselman did not move. He didn't put down the poker. He didn't turn to the wall. Shadow was about to reach for Hinselman to try to take the poker away from him when the old man threw the burning poker at Mulligan. Hinselman threw it awkwardly, lobbing it across the room as if for form's sake, and as he threw it, he was already hurrying for the door. The poker glanced off Mulligan's left arm. The noise of the shot in the close quarters of the old man's room was deafening. One shot to the head, and that was all. Mulligan said,
"Better get your clothes on."
His voice was dull and dead. Shadow nodded. He walked to the room next door, opened the door of the clothes dryer, and pulled out his clothes. The jeans were still damp, but he put them on anyway. By the time he got back to the den, fully dressed, except for his coat, which was somewhere deep in the freezing mud of the lake, and his boots, which he couldn't find, Mulligan had already hauled several smoldering logs out from the fireplace. Mulligan said,
"It's a bad day for a cop when he has to commit arson just to cover up a murder."
Then he looked up at Shadow.
"You need boots," he said.
"I don't know where he put them," said Shadow. "Hell," said Mulligan. Then he said, "Sorry about this, Inselman." And he picked the old man up by the collar and by the belt buckle, and he swung him forward, dropped the body with its head resting in the open fireplace. The white hair crackled and flared, and the room began to fill with the smell of charring flesh.
"It wasn't murder. It was self-defense," said Shadow.
"I know what it was," said Mulligan flatly. He had already turned his attention to the smoking logs he had scattered about the room. He pushed one of them to the edge of the sofa, picked up an old copy of the Lakeside News, and pulled it into its component pages, which he crumpled up and dropped onto the log. The newspaper pages browned and then burst into flame. "Get outside," said Chad Mulligan. He opened the windows as they walked out of the house, and he sprang the lock on the front door to lock it before he closed it. Shadow followed him out to the police car in his bare feet. Mulligan opened the front passenger door for him, and Shadow got in and wiped his feet off on the mat. Then he put on his socks, which were pretty much dry by now. "We can get you some boots at Henning's Farm and Home," said Chad Mulligan.
"How much did you hear in there?" asked Shadow.
"Enough," said Mulligan. Then he said, "Too much." They drove to Henning's Farm and Home in silence. When they got there, the police chief said, "What size feet?" Shadow told him. Mulligan walked into the store. He returned with a pair of thick woolen socks and a pair of leather farm boots. "All they had left in your size," he said. "Unless you wanted gum boots, I figured you didn't." Shadow pulled on the socks and the boots. They fitted fine.
"Thanks," he said.
"You got a car?" asked Mulligan.
"It's parked by the road down to the lake near the bridge."
Mulligan started the car and pulled out of the Hennings parking lot.
"What happened to Audrey?" asked Shadow.
"Day after they took you away, she said she liked me as a friend, but it would never work out between us being family and all, and she went back to Eagle Point. Broke my gosh darn heart."
"Makes sense," said Shadow.
"And it wasn't personal. Inselman didn't need her here anymore." They drove back past Inselman's house. A thick plume of white smoke was coming up from the chimney. "She only came to town because he wanted her here. She helped him get me out of town. I was bringing attention he didn't need. I thought she liked me." They pulled up beside Shadow's rental car.
"What are you going to do now?" asked Shadow.
"I don't know," said Mulligan. His normally harassed face was starting to look more alive than it had at any point since Inselman's den. It also looked more troubled. "I figure I got a couple of choices. Either I'll..." And he made a gun of his first two fingers and put the fingertips into his open mouth and removed them. "Put a bullet through my brain. Or I'll wait another couple of days until the ice is mostly gone and tie a concrete block to my leg and jump off the bridge. Or pills. Sheesh. Maybe I should just drive a while out to one of the forests, take pills out there. I don't want to make one of my guys have to do the cleanup. Leave it for the county, huh?"
He sighed and shook his head.
"You didn't kill Inselman, Chad. He died a long time ago, a long way from here." "Thanks for saying that, Mike, but I killed him. I shot a man in cold blood and I covered it up. And if you asked me why I did it, why I really did it, I'm darned if I could tell you."
Shadow put out a hand, touched Mulligan on the arm. "Inselman owned this town," he said. "I don't think you had a lot of choice about what happened back there. I think he brought you there. He wanted you to hear what you heard. He set you up. I guess it was the only way he could leave."
Mulligan's miserable expression didn't change. Shadow could see that the police chief had barely heard anything that he'd said. He had killed Inselman and built him a pyre. and now, obeying the last of Hinselman's desires, he would commit suicide. Shadow closed his eyes, remembering the place in his head that he had gone when Wednesday had told him to make snow. That place that pushed mind to mind, and he smiled a smile he didn't feel, and he said, "Chad, let it go." There was a cloud in the man's mind, a dark, oppressive cloud, and Shadow could almost see it, and, concentrating on it, imagined it fading away, like a fog in the morning. "Chad," he said, fiercely, trying to penetrate the cloud, "this town is going to change now. It's not going to be the only good town in a depressed region anymore. It's going to be a lot more like the rest of this part of the world. There's going to be a lot more trouble. People out of work, people out of their heads, more people getting hurt, more bad shit going down. They are going to need a police chief with experience. The town needs you." And then he said, "Marguerite needs you." Something shifted in the storm cloud that filled the man's head. Shadow could feel a change. He pushed, then, envisioning Marguerite Olsen's practical brown hands and her dark eyes and her long, long black hair. He pictured the way she tipped her head on one side and half smiled when she was amused. "She's waiting for you," said Shadow. And he knew it was true as he said it. "Margie?" said Chad Mulligan. And at that moment, although he could never tell you how he had done it, and he doubted that he could ever do it again, Shadow reached in to Chad Mulligan's mind, easy as anything, and he plucked the events of that afternoon away from it as precisely and dispassionately as a raven picks an eye from roadkill. The creases in Chad's forehead smoothed, and he blinked sleepily. "Go see Margie," said Shadow. "It's been good seeing you, Chad. Take care of yourself."
"Sure,"
yawned Chad Mulligan. A message crackled over the police radio, and Chad reached out for the handset. Shadow got out of the car. Shadow walked over to his rental car. He could see the gray flatness of the lake at the center of the town. He thought of the dead children who waited at the bottom of the water. Soon, Allison would float to the surface. As Shadow drove past Hinselman's place, he could see the plume of smoke had already turned into a blaze. He could hear a siren wail. He drove south, heading for Highway 51. He was on his way to keep his final appointment. But before that, he thought, he would stop off in Madison for one last goodbye. Best of everything, Samantha Black Crow liked closing up the coffee house at night. It was a perfectly calming thing to do. It gave her a feeling that she was putting order back into the world. She would put on an Indigo Girls CD, and she would do her final chores of the night at her own pace and in her own way. First, she would clean the espresso machine. Then she would do the final rounds, ensuring that any missed cups or plates were deposited back in the kitchen, and that the newspapers that were always scattered around the coffee house by the end of each day were collected together and piled neatly by the front door, all ready for recycling. She loved the coffee house. It was a long, winding series of rooms filled with armchairs and sofas and low tables, on a street lined with second-hand bookstores. She covered the leftover slices of cheesecake and put them into the large refrigerator for the night. Then she took a cloth and wiped the last of the crumbs away. She enjoyed being alone. A tapping on the window jerked her attention from her chores back to the real world. She went to the door, opened it, to admit a woman of about Sam's age, with pigtailed magenta hair. Her name was Natalie. "Hello," said Natalie. She went up on tiptoes and kissed Sam, depositing the kiss snugly between Sam's cheek and the corner of her mouth. You can say a lot of things with a kiss like that.
You done?
Nearly.
You want to see a movie?
Sure, love to. I've got a good 5 minutes left here, though. Why don't you sit and read The Onion?
I saw this week's already.
She sat on a chair near the door, ruffled through the pile of newspapers put aside for recycling, until she found something and read it, while Sam bagged up the last of the money in the till and put it in the safe. They'd been sleeping together for a week now. Sam wondered if this was it, the relationship she'd been waiting for all her life. She told herself that it was just brain chemicals and pheromones that made her happy when she saw Natalie. And perhaps that was what it was. Still, all she knew for sure was that she smiled when she saw Natalie, and that when they were together, she felt comfortable and comforted.
"This paper," said Natalie, "has another one of those articles in it. Is America changing?"
"Well, is it?"
"They don't say. They say that maybe it is, but they don't know how, and they don't know why, and maybe it isn't happening at all."
Sam smiled broadly.
"Well," she said, "that covers every option, doesn't it?"
"I guess."
Natalie's brow creased, and she went back to her newspaper. Sam washed the dishcloth and folded it.
"I think it's just that, despite the government and whatever, everything just feels suddenly good right now. Maybe it's just spring coming a little early. It was a long winter, and I'm glad it's over."
"Me too." A pause.
"It says in the article that lots of people have been reporting weird dreams. I haven't really had any weird dreams. Nothing weirder than normal."
Sam looked around to see if there was anything she had missed. Nope, it was a good job well done. She took off her apron, hung it back in the kitchen. Then she came back and started to turn off the lights.
"I've had some weird dreams recently," she said. "They got weird enough that I actually started keeping a dream journal. I write them down when I wake up, but when I read them, they don't mean anything at all."
She put on her street coat and her one-size-fits-all gloves.
"I did some dream work," said Natalie.
Natalie had done a little of everything, from arcane self-defense disciplines and sweat lodges to feng shui and jazz dancing.
"Tell me, I'll tell you what they mean."
"Okay."
Sam unlocked the door and turned the last of the lights off. She let Natalie out, and she walked out onto the street and locked the door to the coffee house firmly behind her.
"Sometimes I've been dreaming of people who fell from the sky. Sometimes I'm underground, talking to a woman with a buffalo head. And sometimes I dream about this guy I kissed in a bar last month."
Natalie made a noise.
"Something you should have told me about?"
"Maybe, but not like that. It was a fuck-off kiss."
"You were telling him to fuck off?"
"No, I was telling everyone else they could fuck off.
You had to be there, I guess."
Natalie's shoes clicked down the sidewalk. Sam padded on next to her.
"He owns my car," said Sam.
"That purple thing you got at your sister's?"
"Yep."
"What happened to him? Why doesn't he want his car?"
"I don't know. Maybe he's in prison. Maybe he's dead."
"Dead?"
"I guess," Sam hesitated.
"A few weeks back, I was certain he was dead. ESP or whatever. Like, I knew. But then I started to think maybe he wasn't. I don't know. I guess my ESP isn't that hot."
"How long are you going to keep his car?"
"Until someone comes for it. I think it's what he would have wanted."
Natalie looked at Sam, then she looked again. Then she said,
"Where did you get those from?"
"What?"
"The flowers. The ones you're holding, Sam."
"Where'd they come from?"
"Did you have them when we left the coffee house? I would have seen them."
Sam looked down, then she grinned.
"You are so sweet. I should have said something when you gave them to me, shouldn't I? She said. They are lovely. Thank you so much. But wouldn't red have been more appropriate?
They were roses, their stems wrapped in paper, six of them, and white.
I didn't give them to you, said Natalie, her lips firming.
And neither of them said another word until they reached the movie theater. When she got home that night, Sam put the roses in an improvised vase. Later, she cast them in bronze. And she kept to herself the tale of how she got them, although she told Caroline, who came after Natalie, the story of the ghost roses one night when they were both very drunk, and Caroline agreed with Sam that it was a really, really strange and spooky story, and deep down did not actually believe a word of it. So that was all right. Shadow had parked near a payphone. He called information, and they gave him the number. No, he was told, she isn't here. She's probably still at the coffee house. He stopped on the way to the coffee house to buy flowers. He found the coffee house, then he crossed the road and stood in the doorway of a used bookstore and waited and watched. The place closed at 8, and at 8:10, Shadow saw Sam Black Crow walk out of the coffee house in the company of a smaller woman whose pigtailed hair was a peculiar shade of red. They were holding hands tightly, as if simply holding hands could keep the world at bay. And they were talking. Or rather, Sam was doing most of the talking while her friend listened. Shadow wondered what Sam was saying. She smiled as she talked. The two women crossed the road, and they walked past the place where Shadow was standing. The pigtailed girl passed within a foot of him. He could have reached out and touched her. And they didn't see him at all. He watched them walking away from him down the street, and felt a pang like a minor chord being played inside him. It had been a good kiss, Shadow reflected. But Sam had never looked at him the way she was looking at the pigtailed girl. And she never would. What the hell? We'll always have Peru, he said, under his breath, as Sam walked away from him. And El Paso. We'll always have that. Then he ran after her and put the flowers into Sam's hands. He hurried away so she couldn't give them back. Then he walked up the hill, back to his car, and he followed the signs to Chicago. He drove at or slightly under the speed limit. It was the last thing he had to do. He was in no hurry. He spent the night in a Motel 6. He got up the next morning and realized his clothes still smelled like the bottom of the lake. He put them on anyway. He figured he wouldn't need them much longer. Shadow paid his bill. He drove to the brownstone apartment building. He found it without any difficulty. It was smaller than he remembered. He walked up the stairs steadily, not fast. That would have meant he was eager to go to his death. And not slow. That would have meant he was afraid. Someone had cleaned the stairwell. The black garbage bags had gone. The place smelled of the chlorine smell of bleach, no longer of rotting vegetables. The red-painted door at the top of the stairs was wide open. The smell of old meals hung in the air. Shadow hesitated. Then he pressed the doorbell. "I come," called a woman's voice, and dwarf small and dazzlingly blonde, Zoria Utrenyaya came out of the kitchen and bustled towards him, wiping her hands on her apron. She looked different, Shadow realized. She looked happy. Her cheeks were rouged red, and there was a sparkle in her old eyes. When she saw him, her mouth became an O, and she called out, "Shadow? You came back to us?" And she hurried toward him with her arms outstretched. He bent down and embraced her, and she kissed his cheek. "So good to see you," she said. "Now you must go away." Shadow stepped into the apartment, all the doors in the apartment, except, unsurprisingly, Zorya Polunochnaya's, were wide open, and all the windows he could see were open as well. A gentle breeze blew fitfully through the corridor. "Your spring cleaning," he said to Zorya Utranyaya.
"We have a guest coming," she told him. "Now you must go away. First, you want coffee?"
"I came to see Chernobog," said Shadow. "It's time." Zorya Utranyaya shook her head violently.
"No, no," she said. "You don't want to see him. Not a good idea."
"I know," said Shadow. "But you know the only thing I've really learned about dealing with gods is that if you make a deal, you keep it. They get to break all the rules they want. We don't. Even if I tried to walk out of here, my feet would just bring me back." She pushed up her bottom lip, then said,
"It's true. But go today. Come back tomorrow. He will be gone then."
"Who is it?"
called a woman's voice from further down the corridor.
"Zorya Utranyaya, to who are you talking? This mattress I cannot turn on my own, you know."
Shadow walked down the corridor and said, "Good morning, Zorya Vechernyaya. Can I help?" Which made the woman in the room squeak with surprise and drop her corner of the mattress. The bedroom was thick with dust. It covered every surface, the wood and the glass, and motes of it floated and danced through the beams of sunshine coming through the open window, disturbed by occasional breezes and the lazy flapping of the yellowed lace curtains. He remembered this room. This was the room they had given to Wednesday that night, Bielobog's room. Zorya Vechernyaya eyed him uncertainly.
"The mattress," she said. "It needs to be turned."
"Not a problem," said Shadow. He reached out and took the mattress, lifted it with ease, and turned it over. It was an old wooden bed, and the feather mattress weighed almost as much as a man. Dust flew and swirled as the mattress went down.
"Why are you here?"
asked Zorya Vechernyaya. It was not a friendly question, the way she asked it. "I'm here," said Shadow, "because back in December, a young man played a game of checkers with an old god, and he lost." The old woman's gray hair was up on the top of her head in a tight bun. She pursed her lips.
"Come back tomorrow," said Zorya Vechernyaya.
"I can't," he said simply.
"It's your funeral. Now you go and sit down. Zorya Utranyaya will bring you coffee. Chernobog will be back soon."
Shadow walked along the corridor to the sitting room. It was just as he remembered, although now the window was open. The gray cat slept on the arm of the sofa. It opened an eye as Shadow came in, and then, unimpressed, it went back to sleep. This was where he had played checkers with Chernobog. This was where he had wagered his life to get the old man to join them on Wednesday's last doomed grift. The fresh air came in through the open window, blowing the stale air away. Zorya Utranyaya came in with a red wooden tray. A small enameled cup of steaming black coffee sat on the tray, beside a saucer filled with small chocolate chip cookies. She put it down on the table in front of him. "I saw Zorya Polunochnaya again," he said. "She came to me under the world, and she gave me the moon to light my way. And she took something from me, but I don't remember what."
"She likes you," said Zorya Utranyaya. "She dreams so much. And she guards us all. She is so brave."
"Where's Chernobog?"
"He says the spring cleaning makes him uncomfortable. He goes out to buy newspaper, sit in the park, buy cigarettes. Perhaps he will not come back today. You do not have to wait. Why don't you go? Come back tomorrow."
"I'll wait," said Shadow. There was no magic forcing him to wait. He knew that. This was him. It was one last thing that needed to happen. And if it was the last thing that happened, well, he was going there of his own volition. After this, there would be no more obligations, no more mysteries, no more ghosts. He sipped the hot coffee, as black and as sweet as he remembered. He heard a deep male voice in the corridor, and he sat up straighter.